One of the most significant changes in the time I've been investing in property, and that's close to 5 decades now, one of the most significant changes has been the availability of data. When I first started investing in the early 1970s, there weren't any blogs, there weren't podcasts, YouTube channels. In fact, the only way you could get property data was to be part of the secret inner circle, which was then a men's club of real estate agents. Because the lag in publicly available data, it was often over a year. Estate agents were the custodians of the data because back then the Valuer General would only publicly release property data about once a year. Now, over the past decade, there's been an abundance of monthly data available for property investors and home buyers. And over the last year, most of the data houses have been providing weekly updates, as I have been in Property Update. But in our current fast-moving market, sometimes even this is a little bit slow. For property investors who need to make important financial decisions, the lag in available data can be an issue. And the other significant challenge is understanding which data is important, considering there's so much of it. You've got to know which is important, which isn't. And that's the topic of my chat today with financial advisor Stuart Weems. So at the end of today's show, you should have a much better understanding of what data you should be paying attention to and where to find it. And this could help you become a better property investor by making better decisions. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
It seems that currently every man, woman and their pet dog are upbeat about the property markets. Just look at the messages we're getting in the media. It seems that all the economists have now done an about-face and agree we're in for strong property markets in the next few years, with some being comfortable using the word boom already. I've even heard bubble used once or twice. In fact, they seem to be outdoing each other. They want to come up with who's got the most upbeat price increase forecasts. We're going to get 6% gains this year. How about 8%? No, we're going to get double-digit growth. I've even heard 16% growth over the next 2 years from the CBA Bank. But looking back over the last few years, we know that most economists have had a very poor track record, and we know that much of the information we read in the media isn't useful in making investment decisions. So today, I'm going to have a chat with Stuart Weems to get an understanding of what information is relevant and what's not. Now, for those of you who don't know Stuart, he's an independent financial advisor. He's an author who's regularly published in the Australian newspaper. He's a podcaster and regularly writes blogs on his own website and on Property Update. Boy, what a mouthful. Welcome, Stuart.
Great to be with you again, Michael. And that was a mouthful. No wonder I'm tired.
Yes, you're very active and you're everywhere. Now, Stuart, I've found that in reality, much of the content produced by the media, and we both get quoted a lot in the media, so I respect the people that are there, but I've found it relatively useless for making property investment decisions. They tend to run stories that they consider newsworthy, that are time sensitive. What happened yesterday, the 5 big tips for tomorrow, but this short-term information isn't really as useful if you're intending to make your property investments based on long-term factors in it for the decade. So, Stuart, what information do you find relevant?
In the media, Michael, not a lot. Independent content producers like you and I, although it sounds probably a little arrogant to say, probably produce better or more meaningful content or more useful content for investors than what the broad media does. If I'm going to sit down and write a piece for The Australian, it needs to be newsworthy. It needs to be current, which means that it kind of, if you read the same article 6 months later, it kind of needs to be out of date, that it's no longer. Now, that sort of noise, that sort of short-term focus, it's interesting. It might be, you know, mentally stimulating to read those sorts of things, but I liken it to watching a sitcom on TV. You know, you could sit down and watch Friends or Seinfeld. They're funny programs, but you're never going to learn anything, and there's nothing that you're going to learn to apply to life or anything like that. I probably compare that to, say, a documentary. If you watch a documentary on TV, you're going to learn more and grow as a human being, etc. So I think then we need to make sure that when we're reading this information, we need to ask ourselves very consciously, because if we don't ask ourselves consciously, our subconscious will take over. Is this information important? Is it going to inform me? And most of the commentary in respect to property is macroeconomic commentary. It's homogenous commentary. It's sort of saying, well, Australian property will grow at 6%. What does that actually mean? Every single property in Australia? Does it mean there's other areas that in fact will grow at a faster rate or a slower rate than that? How does it inform me about the growth rates of investment grade locations versus non-investment grade locations? So it's interesting. It sells newspapers, but I think it has very little application on a fundamental basis for making personal investment decisions.
Sure. I think we've got to remember that the media's job is not to educate you, but to entertain you. They've already sold the space on their websites for your eyeballs. They've got advertisers that they've got to please. So clickbait headlines work really well. And they actually work on fear and greed and on your emotions and how am I going to make money quickly or how I'm going to not lose money. So I understand what you're saying. So I know you've always talked about evidence-based economy. So when you're talking about these sort of things, I think we've got to go back and look at what really drives property values. Because if we talk about the median property values, I've heard you say that it costs the same to hold a good property or a bad property. So you may as well own the best property you can.
Yeah, that's right. And so if we think then, how does it apply to investment grade property? What we need to remind ourselves is what are the fundamental factors that an investment grade property possesses in order to generate perpetual capital growth? Perpetual and sustainable capital growth, and I'll probably underline sustainable, because what we want to do is buy a property, hold it for 2, 3, 4 decades and enjoy lots of the growth. Every day, I'm sure you have the same thing, Michael, every day in our business, I get reminded how patience is so important when investing in property. I have a client that has owned a few properties in Batemans Bay. He lives there for many years. He's been a client for nearly 20 years, and these properties have done not a lot over that time in terms of capital growth, but they're adjoining properties close to the sort of shopping strip there. I have never been to Batemans Bay, but apparently they're positioned well for development. And it's only this year that he's sold those properties and really cashed in. If you track the returns or charted the returns, it would be like a hockey stick at the end. So, you know, he's held the property for 20 or more years and all the returns have come in the last 2 or 3 years. So you and I see stories like that all the time that show that it's the fundamentals and the fundamentals will work, but it obviously requires patience. But we need to remind ourselves of what those fundamentals look like. And there's really three things. It's land value, it's scarcity. So the scarcity needs to be attached to the land value. It's great to have a strong land value, but if it's in the middle of nowhere that no one wants to buy, it's not going to work for you. And then proven performance. You know, you can go back and track what has the performance been over a 30-year period in Batemans Bay, for example. You're probably going to see some good numbers perhaps over a 2 or 3 or 5 year period. Maybe it's terrible. Maybe the numbers aren't so great, but that doesn't really help us.
A couple of things come to mind from the discussion you've just had. One is that, as Warren Buffett clearly said, wealth is the transfer of money from the impatient to the patient. So you do have to take a long-term approach, which is different to how most people want things. It's human to want to get rich in a hurry, but it doesn't really work that way. The other point that you were making earlier on was how the media generalizes, and it doesn't work. So there are people are saying that a regional town has had a particular level of capital growth and it's outperformed Sydney. But you can't compare a regional town of 20,000 people, and that's a big one, or 5,000 people, to a city of Sydney of 5 million or Melbourne of 5 million. So they're not comparing apples with apples, they're comparing apples with oranges. And really, you've got to compare it with a particular suburb. You've got to be more granular. So we know the Sydney property market of Melbourne or Brisbane or Perth isn't a property market. There's houses, apartments, townhouses, there's different price points, there's inner city, there's middle ring, there's outer suburbs. So therefore, one has to be much more granular. And that does come from the data houses, but even they tend to be confusing at times. I know that you are a numbers person, and being a financial advisor, you've always had the perspective that numbers are important, but they're not always right. In fact, I believe you can sort of make numbers say almost anything you want.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason that numbers don't really help us inform us in regards to property decisions is they tend to be macro and they will apply to all property, really. They're a representation of all property, good, bad, the ugly, fantastic, very poor property that you'd never invest in. And so everything gets kind of mixed up. If you could somehow in Australia identify every investment grade asset and then derive numbers off that, that would be incredibly valuable information, but it just doesn't exist. A good example of how numbers start informing the property story but really have no application, a really good one is the whole property supply story. You know, how many houses are we building? What's our population growth? You know, if there's more land releases and they're building a new suburb, for example, you know, 35, 40 Ks out from the capital city CBD, let's say in Melbourne, how is that going to impact the value of a house in Hawthorne? I mean, it's just not. It just has no impact. The only impact that some of these things that the media will talk about is that sometimes they impact or stimulate overall economic activity. Overall economic activity is very good because people that are running businesses that live in Hawthorne, you know, will make more money and that'll stimulate that market. But apart from that, you know, how many houses we're building, okay, certainly at a macro level, there's the supply demand. We all need a home to live in. And if it gets way out of balance, you know, the overall market changes. But, you know, a lot of these factors that the media talk about just don't have a lot of application. And so I think that's where experience comes in, Michael. I mean, experience kind of tells us which data is relevant and which is not. Which should I act upon or which should concern me and which is not? And obviously, we've been both in the industry for a long time. So sometimes I'll read something and some commentary and think, well, just, what a lot of rubbish. That is just a lot of noise. Good article, but, you know, it's probably going to invite people to make mistakes rather than make good quality decisions. I think you need a combination of both. You need some data. Some data is useful, particularly if it's property specific or street specific sort of data that can build a bit of picture around past performance and so forth. But the experience element, you can't reproduce. You know, you can't search experience online.
Well, you're calling it experience. I'll often call it perspective, but it's the same thing because history does have a way of teaching us, if you learn the lessons from history, of what's important, what isn't, and what's going on. So we've both written similar things. It's interesting how we do think similarly, and that's why I love our conversations, that property investment is part art and part science. And that's where investors who only base their decision on data, or particularly base it on data, are getting it wrong. I know there's a couple of people out there currently saying that they research every property market around Australia sitting at their computers all day. Unfortunately, what they're missing is the perspective. They may get the science bit of the science and art right. They've got the data, but they haven't got the art bit right, the perspective. They haven't got the on-the-ground knowledge. And over the last year or two, I know a lot of these buyer's agents who are doing this, they haven't even been able to fly in and out. So they're actually doing it purely based on data. And I know some people say, well, that's okay because it takes the emotion out wrong. You can't see the aspect. You can't see why one side of the street is better than the other. That takes years to develop. As you say, it's something you can't buy. So property investment is part art and part science. But even with the science bit, you actually need to know what data is important and what isn't. So we've already said, well, having very wide-reaching data isn't useful. The most common thing people tend to quote is the median price. That's one that's so irrelevant that we pay no attention to the median price in Melbourne. Sometimes not even the median price in a suburb. The suburb I live in Brighton, there are three or four different pockets, precincts, the area close to the beach performs very, very differently to areas not close to the beach. The areas on the other side of Nepean Highway don't perform as well as on this side of Nepean Highway. How can you compare the median price of Brighton? And that's a distinct example, but there are lots of them like that. So median price gives you an indication of the middle range of that property, that group of properties that sold recently. But if all of a sudden there's been a new development of either cheaper or more expensive homes, it can skew it. So there's a number of areas where data is not really very helpful. I think the other thing is there's certain areas, certain suburbs, Stuart, where there isn't as many transactions, so it's not as valuable, or when the properties within the suburb are not similar. If they're more homogenous, median prices are more valuable.
Yeah, that's right. I remember when the Rudd government doubled the first homeowners grant just around the time of the GFC. I think it was 09, 010. And we found that, you know, a lot of first home buyers rushed into the market, take advantage of those grants. So they worked, well, they did what they wanted, what the government wanted to do at that time. But it just meant that lower end properties were selling, more lower end properties proportionately were selling in certain locations. And that skewed kind of median prices. So at that stage, it looked like prices were a little off, falling a little bit, but it's just the transactions that were occurring. So I think suburb data doesn't really help very much. Capital city data might give us a flavour of the overall market and sentiment and what's going on, which is a good context to have, because if you've got a property that's done nothing in terms of growth and the overall market has appreciated by 10% over the last 10 years each year, then you've got yourself a dud asset. So I think it provides some context. But in terms of informing me where to invest, do I invest in Melbourne or Brisbane or Sydney and which suburb within and then which street within, none of that data really helps. You've got to then drill down, to my mind. Part of it will be, you know, some of that decision making will be informed a little bit by the actual data of the actual property that you're contemplating and the one next door if it's comparable and the one across the street if that's comparable, to start building a bit of a data set, a bit of a picture. But even then we need to be really careful, right? Because is the data sort of arm's length? I remember doing an exercise for a blog I wrote a few years ago, and I picked a property that I knew well, and then I looked at some other transactions in the same street. It reminded me that one of my clients had bought a property from their parents, but it wasn't sold at fair market value, but the recorded sale was at what they paid, which wasn't really representative for fair market value. So sometimes you don't even know how reliable the actual data is, just because a property sold for $600,000, if it wasn't arm's length, it was between family members, you know, that's going to skew sort of growth rates and these sorts of things. And so I remember going through that exercise, I thought, oh, wow, it just happened by luck. I forgot that a client was in the area, but it just happened by luck that I knew the background to that transaction. But again, you've got to be really, really careful about being too data driven. And I think it invites people to make mistakes.
I know we both use a holistic approach to advise our clients. And so I think it starts with the top level of the macroeconomic factors involved and putting a strategic wealth plan together to decide where they want to go, and then get down to the property level, state, suburbs, group of suburbs, and then the property. So if we go up a level, there's so many data points, so many macroeconomic considerations, but in my mind they probably only fall down to a handful. I think when you first start getting involved in property investment or in any field, you think there are a million things you need to know, and the answer is probably not, Stuart. You probably need to know half a dozen things, or understand them and follow them, and the others are nowhere near as important.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's probably about four that I can really identify that really will inform me about what might happen in an investment grade location. The first one's population growth. And I don't say population growth because the more our population grows, the more houses we need. And if we aren't building enough, that creates a shortage in supply, which will translate to price appreciation. That may or may not happen, but that's not really the reason. Population growth is more important for economic growth. What I'm more concerned about is buying an area that is dominated by people whose income is increasing at a much faster rate than the average. So I want to be in an area that's where I've got investment bankers and people that are running large businesses and, you know, these sorts of people that if economic activity is very buoyant, these people will get a greater share of the pie. So their income will be increasing.
Stuart, they've also probably got multiple streams of income as well, these people. So they've got share income, they've got dividends, they've got property. So apart from having high incomes, they're the ones who coped really well over the last couple of years during the financial challenges of COVID.
Yeah, they're better off. I mean, the data shows that the top 40% of income earners have a higher income today than what they had previous to the virus. And they've probably got more money in the bank too because they're not going on overseas holidays.
Sure. So it's not a judge of people, but it really is one of the driving factors of what how you decide, how you advise and how we decide with regard to demographics. It has got to do with people's income earning capacity because that's going to decide how much they can borrow, how much they can afford to pay for homes, how much they can renovate their homes. And as you say, the current statistics show that that group of people have done better and are more likely to continue to. That's a whole different social argument we can discuss one day, but the rich are getting richer all around the world and COVID's only accentuated that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not a good outcome, I think, for society that
it's not.
The distribution of wealth is so unfair. So we can talk about it and we should probably as a country take actions to arrest it. But the reality is that it's probably not going to change. It's been happening like this for 100-200 years. It's going to continue on that trajectory. So then if we want to invest in property in a location where people always have the propensity or the ability to pay more to get into that location, which is what you want, which is what you need for perpetual growth, then the demographics of the people that are attracted to that location are incredibly important.
So I interrupted you. You started to say there are four important macroeconomic considerations. One is population growth, but digging deeper, it was even more so the sort of population growth. And it's not because of demand, but because of the economic activity that's occurring because of that. The second one I would be suggesting is money supply. Wouldn't it be the availability of finance? Because property is really a game of finance, which you've written a book about, The Rules of Finance. So well, we can talk about that later.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, if the banks aren't going to lend anyone any money, given that most people aren't going out and paying cash for their property acquisitions, they need borrowings. If the banks stop lending tomorrow, you know, that money supply will have a big impact on property price growth and so forth. Whereas if we've got a strong supply of money, like if we think pre-GFC, for example, you know, that stimulates growth. And we've looked at the relationship between the volume of new mortgages approved and subsequent price growth, and there's a positive relationship there. So we know that money supply is an issue. So we know, for example, if the banks turned around tomorrow and said, all right, guys, we're going to halve our borrowing capacity, that will have an impact on future price growth. So that's one of those considerations. Now, I think with money supply, there's not much we as investors can do about it, and it will ebb and flow over periods of time. I think we've been through a correction with money supply. I think borrowing capacity probably peaked just before the GFC. I think it's come down now. I don't think it will change very much from here on in. So really, people's borrowing capacity will be driven or closely tied to their income. So for people or people in occupations where they've got growing income, they'll have growing borrowing capacity, but then the reverse is true also. So I guess it informs us or makes that demographic decision around the what are the demographics attracted to a particular location even more important over the next few decades than it has been over the last few decades.
Right. What's the other important macroeconomic considerations?
The third one is diversified employment opportunities. So again, not necessarily because we want a larger pool of potential purchasers or a larger pool of potential renters, but again, it informs us about the overall economic growth. So a really good example would be, I've got a client that's a chief marketing officer for listed companies. He was living in Melbourne for family reasons, moved to Brisbane. There aren't a lot of good job opportunities for him in Brisbane because there's not a lot of head offices in Brisbane compared to Melbourne and Sydney. So Melbourne and Sydney are going to attract those higher income earners because of those diversified job opportunities. Now, that's just one example, but of course, there's There's lots. And essentially, you want to invest in a capital city or location that isn't reliant upon one sector, that has a diverse sector, but can attract those higher income earners. And that's what a small town's not going to be able to do, or less likely they're able to do. So if you're going to invest in a location where everyone's income stays the same, how are they ever going to afford to pay more for property? Property will get to a certain value and it'll hover there, move in line with inflation, but there's not much growth there. Whereas if you're investing again in an area where a CMO, a CFO or whatever gets a bonus of another $100,000 or a share package or whatever that adds to their overall wealth and ability to pay more, that's where you're going to get price growth.
Well, I think what you just answered is the question, should I be investing in some of these small regional capital cities that are getting growth at the moment and they're performing nicely, but the question is, how long is that going to continue? At the moment, there's a bit of a push with people moving to areas which are still commutable. They're wanting slightly different lifestyle changes. And small numbers of people moving to these towns can make a big difference just because of the 5,000 people leaving Melbourne isn't going to make a big difference to Melbourne's capital growth, but spread them around five towns in regional Melbourne, regional Victoria, and it'll make a difference to their capital growth in the short term. But if the people living there aren't the sort that are going to have above average wages growth, it's a one-off hit, it's a sugar hit, but it's not going to get you that asset base that you're looking for to fund that longest holiday you're ever going to have when you retire.
That's right. And remember, we're investing for decades, not just years. Everything is cyclical. All industries move in cycles and so forth. That's going to happen. But if you have that diversification and there's enough underlying demand that's going to ensure that that diverse employment opportunities persist for many decades, that's what you really want. I guess we see it in WA, or certainly we've seen over the last 15 years or 20 years in WA, there's a mining boom, everything went crazy, the mining boom ended, everything didn't go crazy, and all of a sudden now iron ore's price is at all-time highs again, and WA markets are kicking off again. That's okay, things move in cycles, but it just means that's a higher risk proposition than, say, a more diversified capital city like Sydney and Melbourne.
There's no doubt that Perth's going to have a couple of good years. It's had a terrible decade, but I agree with you that its overall economy is too dependent upon one industry. And then there's the geopolitical problems with a lot of the exports going to one country. So I concur with your words. There's more risk there. And part of an investor's job is to maximize their returns while minimizing their risks. There's always opportunities if you're prepared to take big risks, but you and I as advisors can't recommend or shouldn't recommend people taking risks. Now, the last of the big macroeconomic factors, what's that one, Stuart?
Infrastructure. So infrastructure helps inform us about, you know, how easy it is to sort of get around and also enjoy the amenities and the employment opportunities that living very close to the capital city offers. And Australia has a really big problem because we've only got about 15 million taxpayers. Of course, there's about 25 million population, but in terms of taxpayers, we've got 15, 16, 17 million, somewhere around that mark. But we've got a massive country. Like if we compare ourselves to Europe, UK, even the US to some degree, the density is just not there. And that's why living close to a capital city is so important, because it helps us, you know, where our kids go to school, our employment opportunities, and then what we do on the weekends and after work on a school night, you know, whether we can go to a nice restaurant or catch a live show or something along those lines. If we live 50 Ks away from the CBD, we don't have almost any of that amenity. I mean, you'll have a Coles, you'll have a GP, you know, a doctor and so forth, but to get into the city's an hour drive, etc. So infrastructure then will inform us really around, I think, longer term, the distribution of growth. So, you know, even if Melbourne's growing at 7%, for example, over the next 30 years, that means that maybe those outlying areas, because they're not well serviced by infrastructure, and I think most people would agree Australia's underinvested in infrastructure, they're going to grow less than 7%. And then, of course, there's going to be locations that are going to grow higher than 7%. But let's just say if the government decided to turn around and go, all right, let's liquidate the Future Fund and put that all into infrastructure. Now, the Future Fund was to fund pension liabilities, but put that aside. And there was a massive investment in infrastructure, and living in a regional town was no longer going to be a problem. You know, the commute was going to be resolved. Then I think we'd see price growth a lot more even throughout Australia. There wouldn't be such a strong demand to live in Hawthorne in Melbourne, for example, or Bondi in Sydney. I mean, I think that's just so unlikely to happen. The less we invest in infrastructure, I think the more accentuated the differential growth rates will be over the longer term.
Well, we started the conversation by asking what property data should we pay attention to? And I think we've realised that not all the data is relevant. Be careful who you listen to. Be careful what media you listen to. But it actually hasn't helped people decide then, how am I going to interpret it? Because it's going to take a lot of people listening to this many years of perspective and making mistakes. So you and I have learned our lessons, partly from making our own mistakes, partly from seeing clients who've made mistakes, and part of the educational process that you're doing in your blogs, you're doing in your Investopoly podcast, I'm doing in this podcast, is to help people prevent making mistakes. So one of the bits of advice I'd like to finish with, and I know some people are going to say it's self-serving, is take advice. Don't try and be smart and do it all yourself, interpret it all yourself. You and I have access to quite a significant amount of data that we pay for, we research for. We spend an embarrassing amount of time reading every day to keep up to date with what's going on. And so while the average person can't buy the perspective, they can hire it. They can get your team to put a financial plan together, to get a mortgage, to get tax advice. They can use my team to put a strategic property plan together. And yes, it does come at a cost. On the other hand, the cheapest advice you're going to get is the one that makes you money. The most expensive advice you're going to get is probably free and allow you to make mistakes. So if people want to find out a bit more about you, your services, your books, how do they find out about it, Stuart?
I'll get onto that. I just might say, I guess the thing with a data-driven approach is it seems very logical. And I think people can follow it, understand the logic, and think, well, we've got such a large data set with so deep research, it's got to be right. And it's very compelling. It's very convincing. And so therefore, I think when you follow that without any advice, without someone on the ground saying, you just wouldn't buy 13 Smith Street because it never works, and my 20 years of experience tells me that, in the absence of receiving that sort of advice, you don't even know you're making a mistake. You're going to make the investment. It's underpinned by this very robust research. So you think, I'm bang on here. You know, this suburb or this location or this street is going to outperform over the next 10 years. You're then going to accept that opinion, and then you're going to have to wait 10 years to work out that you were wrong or find out that you were wrong. It's an incredible waste of time. Whereas if you engaged an expert in that location, a local area expert that knows 13 Smith Street, and ask them, I'm going about to buy 13 Smith Street. What do you reckon? Do you think it's a good idea? And any decent experienced buyer's agent's probably going to turn around and go, no, you'd be crazy. And here's all the reasons why. And that's when I think it reveals to people data only gets us so far. And that experience of speaking to someone that's been on the ground for years, that looks at property 6 days a week, that knows the ins and outs, that's the missing element. So I'm not saying data is not worthwhile, but you need to have that context of that experience.
Part art, part science, as we both said, yes.
So to find me, just Google Investopoly. Just Google that, it'll take you to my book or blog, and I'd invite all podcasts, and I'd invite people just to start listening, and maybe it might resonate with them.
Perfect. So we discussed the Investopoly book a couple of weeks ago, where we had two segments discussing your 8 golden rules. I think people should get your book Investopoly and listen to your podcast Investopoly, and you'll be back again on the Michael Yardney podcast real soon. Thanks for your time today, Stuart.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Great fun.
In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you. I'm going to teach you about walking through the hot sand. But hey, don't turn off just yet, because there's a great message in that. But before I do, I just want to just follow on the conversation I had with Stuart Weems about our changing property markets. And sure, the markets are moving on. But just to make it clear, not all properties are going to increase in value. Well, some are going to increase significantly more than others. And now, more than ever, not just the correct location selection, but the correct property selection within that location is important. But even more than that, as you've often heard me say, property investment isn't just an event, it's a journey. It's a complex procedure where the right things have to be done in the right order. So just looking at the property or just looking at the market on its own without getting your finance structures in place, your ownership structures in place, financial planning in place, cash flow management, is a recipe for disaster, because the current bull market that we're getting is going to slow down. And as always, some people are going to get caught out. So in my mind, in interesting times like we're currently experiencing, you need an advisor who's going to take that holistic approach to your wealth creation, not just a buyer's agent, in fact, not just a property strategist. And let me bluntly say that at Metropole, we help our clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through a range of services. So why not go to metropole.com.au and find out what my team does? We give strategic advice. It all starts with building you a strategic property plan for you and your family, because planning brings your future into the present so you can do something about it now. Sure, we've got Australia's most trusted buyer's agency, wealth advisory, financial planning, property management, renovations, development. But it all starts with putting a plan together for you so you know where you're heading, what you've got to do and what you shouldn't do. Go to metropole.com.au, find out a bit more about what we do, and I look forward to being part of your wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
My mindset message today is that you're going to have to walk through hot sands in order to find the ideal spot on your beach. Now, if you're a beach person, you're going to understand what I mean. On many beaches, in order to get that nice, comfortable spot, you're going to have to trudge through a seemingly endless amount of scorching hot sand. You're going to be carrying an umbrella, some chairs, an esky, many other things as well, and dragging the kids behind you. And if you don't properly prepare yourself for the pain by wearing thongs, sneakers, or shoes, the journey through the hot sand towards the cool ocean will be almost unbearable. Now, I remember many years ago, Pam and I were doing a tour of Israel, and we were going to go to the Dead Sea. You know, that's where the water is so salty that you can't sink. You just float. It keeps you afloat the whole time. So we went on a bus tour there, and we got onto what we thought was a beach. It was going to be a beach, but it wasn't. Rocks, pebbles. It was an uncomfortable walk, and boy, was it quite some distance to the ocean. And as I was walking along, my feet were in pain. I couldn't be bothered. I didn't want to go further. And Pam said, no, you've got to. You've come all this way. You can't not go there. She encouraged me. And it was worth it. It was an amazing experience. I guess what I'm telling you is your success journey is going to be a lot like that journey towards the ocean. You're going to have to endure pain, the pain of your own success journey, in order to realize success. I don't know what that pain is going to be, but it will be obstacles, pitfalls, mistakes, failures, rejection, indifference by people that were important to you. It's going to be a roller coaster of emotions that make the journey, at times, almost unbearable. Most, unfortunately, never make it to their spot on the beach. They underestimate the pain of the journey, and as a result, the scorching hot sand is simply too hot for them to handle, or those rocky, pebbly beaches are just too painful under their feet. So they quit. And you know what? Often it's just before they succeed. But the few who do succeed are able to do so when the pain that does come to them, they can endure it because they're prepared for it. The key to realizing success is not tolerating the pain of the journey towards success, but preparing for it. You've got to expect obstacles to be in your way. You better be prepared for the pitfalls. You've got to expect that there's going to be mistakes, there's going to be failures. And above all, you've got to understand that the journey's going to be long and painful. So when those who succeed encounter the hot sands along the path, they're ready for it. They bring their sneakers or their thongs, or if you're in New Zealand, their flip-flops with them. Being prepared for the pain enables you to focus on one thing and one thing only, getting to the ocean, getting to your spot on the beach. As we're getting close to the end of another show, I'd like to say thank you for spending the time with me, because I know there are so many options to listen to today. And I'd also like to ask you a favour, because my aim is to make as many people as financially successful as possible and take advantage of the current property cycle. So if you know somebody who'd get some benefit from it, please let them know about the show. Use the share button on the podcast app you're listening to right now, or just tell them about it. And if you'd like to tell the world, why not leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Play or Spotify, wherever you listen to this. And if I read it out, as I'm about to for Joshua M.K., who left a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and you email me, michael@metropole.com.au, I'd love to say thank you by gifting you one of my books. And Joshua said, highly informative, great podcast, not only for people interested in property, but for people who want to improve in every aspect of their life. A wide range of topics in his podcast, from financial to gratification. Thank you very much, Michael. Well, thank you, Joshua, for taking the time and trouble to leave that review. Be in contact with me, and I'd be happy to gift you one of my books. Now, in between these twice weekly shows, you can catch me on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney. Or why not join me in my private Facebook group, where once a day I leave a little tip, a little something special exclusive for the people who are interested in furthering their knowledge about property, money or finance. Just look on Facebook and go for the Property Update Facebook group. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?